Major funding for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Virginia, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and an anonymous donor.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Brian Ballow, and I'm here with Peter Onuf.
Hey there, Brian.
And Ed Ayers is with us.
Well, hello, gentlemen. Let's begin today with a holiday fable.
For decades, if you visited the town of Leesburg, Virginia in December, you would see a nativity scene on the courthouse lawn right downtown.
The creche featured full-size statues of the Virgin Mary, the baby Jesus, and the three wise men gathered around the manger. It was a beloved tradition, says Washington Post reporter Caitlin Gibson.
Leesburg is a town with a deep sense of history and tradition, and people who have lived here for decades or even generations are accustomed to things being done a certain way, and change is hard.
In 2009, Loudoun County, where Leesburg is the county seat, announced that it was ending the holiday display, and many Leesburg residents were outraged.
It's been a decades-long tradition of a nativity scene and tree at the courthouse grounds, which fired up the debate over separation of church and state and freedom of speech.
Soon, hundreds of county residents began lobbying to keep the creche. Some showed up at county board meetings wearing Santa hats. But the hubbub also drew in area residents who were not as fond of the traditional creche.
And because Loudoun is a growing community, there's an increasingly diverse and eclectic group of people with a range of different opinions. And the American atheists in particular, they're very serious about what they're trying to convey. And they don't think there should be a county-sponsored religious display, period.
As a compromise, Leesburg decided to issue 10 permits on a first-come, first-served basis to anybody, secular or religious, who wanted a display. And here's where the story takes a turn.
The organization American Atheists thought that religious displays had no place on government property. So they tried to get all 10 permits. That way there wouldn't be any display on the courthouse lawn. No creche, no menorah, nothing at all. But they only got 7 of the 10, so instead they decided to set up some, well, creative displays.
I believe the first displays to cause a bit of a stir was a mannequin Luke Skywalker.
The next year, there was a nativity scene in which a flying spaghetti monster hovered over the baby Jesus, and the display read, "Touched by an angel hair."
Things really hit a fever pitch in 2011 when a skeleton Santa Claus was mounted on a cross and displayed on the lawn, and that had been intended to convey society's obsession with consumerism, but it really upset passing people on the sidewalk.
It actually wasn't the atheists who put up the crucified Santa, but complaints poured in anyway. So Loudoun County decided to ditch the permit system and revert to a county-sponsored nativity scene. But this time, they included some nods to non-Christians, like a menorah, a reindeer, and a healthy, non-crucified Santa.
The new display satisfied the traditionalists, since it brought back the beloved creche. But as Leesburg becomes bigger and more diverse, there are more and more people in the town who just don't want a county-sponsored display at all.
You know, they are members of this community now, and I think that they also feel like they want the courthouse that's at the center of, you know, this historic town to reflect their sense of what's right as well.
This year, creche, menorah, and Santa are already ensconced on the Leesburg courthouse lawn. But Caitlin Gibson says that's probably not a permanent resolution.
I am keeping an eye on it, yes. I definitely am.
Leesburg, of course, is just one of many American towns trying to figure out how to navigate the holiday season without endorsing any one religion.
And these controversies extend well beyond the annual creche versus menorah debate. This fall, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a potentially landmark case from a small town in New York. The question at stake, is it constitutional to open town meetings with a Christian prayer?
So today on the show, the long, uneasy, and still unsettled history of church and state in America. The First Amendment says that Congress can neither establish a state religion nor prohibit Americans from practicing their own religions. But what does it mean to establish a religion or to practice a religion? How have those meanings changed over the centuries? And what counts as a religion anyway?
But first, let's go back to the beginning. What did the founders actually mean with this business about separation between church and state? On cable TV, it all depends on who you ask. Take this recent exchange on CNN between former Senator Rick Santorum and former Governor Howard Dean.
I don't think that's what the First Amendment stands for.
It says Congress shall establish no law regarding the establishment of a religion.
Or the free exercise thereof.
That's pretty clear. Your employer doesn't get to tell you what...
Or the free exercise thereof. You didn't finish the First Amendment. Or the free...
Part of the confusion comes from the fact that the First Amendment's reference to religion has two parts. There's the free exercise clause. That's the part that says Congress can't prohibit people from practicing their religions. This is the part conservatives tend to focus on. For liberals, on the other hand, the Establishment Clause raises the hot-button issues. That's the part that prohibits an establishment of religion by the government.
Liberals believe that that, in fact, separated church and state, and so that the genius of the First Amendment and the American arrangement is that church and state was separate, religion flourished in the United States, and we had religious peace.
That's historian David Sahat, author of The Myth of American Religious Freedom. He says that both sides of the political spectrum tell stories about the separation of church and state that, you know, just are not quite right. We'll get to the conservatives in a little bit. But first, let's explore the liberal take on church and state. Sahat says there's one big problem with the idea that the First Amendment sets up a hard separation.
A lot of people don't realize that the Bill of Rights didn't apply to the states. If you read, in fact, the First Amendment, it says very clearly, Congress shall not make a law. It's a prohibition against Congress, but not states. And so when the First Amendment was passed, there was six states that paid institutional churches. That is, they paid churches out of the public treasury. But beyond that, there were lots of laws that protected religion in various ways. There were blasphemy laws, so you couldn't blaspheme Jesus Christ or God in general. There were Sabbath laws protecting what you could do and not do on Sunday. And so in many ways, both subtle and not subtle, states favored Christianity and often Protestant Christianity in particular.
And Sahat says this leads us to a key text that many liberals misunderstand, Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists. In the early 1800s, Connecticut was one of the states that had an established religion, Congregationalism. Baptists in the town of Danbury were persecuted because, although Christian, they weren't Congregationalist.
In 1802, President Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists to say he hoped that someday Connecticut would stop persecuting them. He said there ought to be a wall of separation between church and state. But Jefferson couldn't actually do anything for the Danbury Baptists because the Bill of Rights didn't apply to the states. So Connecticut's laws weren't unconstitutional.
Connecticut did actually separate its government from the Congregational Church in 1818. But the Supreme Court did not apply the Establishment Clause to the states until 1947. And when they did, the court first invoked Jefferson's wall of separation.
What that meant was prior to 1947, if, let's say, Connecticut decided, you know, we made a mistake back in the early 19th century. We actually should be paying churches. They could have done so, theoretically. But in 1947, the court said, actually, no, you really can't do that because the First Amendment and the Establishment Clause applies to the states. And so, and they used that phrase, the wall of separation, to explain what the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment meant.
Right. And David, you'd be inclined to say with many conservative commentators that that's bad law. That is, of course, distorting history.
Yeah, I don't know that I would call it bad law. Because the court actually gave a sort of a narrative that claimed that church and state had been separate the entire time up until that point. And they were just sort of clarifying. And right. I would call it bad history in support of a defensible law.
Yeah, we don't care about law. History is what matters to us on this show. So let's pivot to the conservatives. What do they claim about the historic original relationship between church and state in America?
conservatives look back at the past and they see all these connections between church and state, the ways in which Christianity or Protestant Christianity were protected. And they say that that was put in place for a reason, that that's how the founders in particular wanted to support religion, that they did in fact create the First Amendment to allow for the public support of religion. And so conservatives claim that this is part of the genius of the American arrangement, that the First Amendment allowed the freedom of religion that liberals really are trying to overturn by a kind of aggressive secularism.
Okay, so David, what's the downside with this conservative position?
Well, I think conservatives, when they look back at the past, it's too often tinged with nostalgia, and they don't acknowledge the real coercion inherent in many of the arrangements of the past. If you say to somebody you can't blaspheme God, what you're really saying is you need to keep your religious beliefs, even if that includes the disbelief in God. You have to really keep that to yourself, because any kind of expression of disbelief could, in some cases, be interpreted as blasphemy. And if you take that and you sort of spread that over and look at all the different laws and ways in which states supported or protected Christianity, you begin to see a kind of coercive society that I think even many conservatives, if they really confronted, would pull back from.
And where does that leave us? Let's say that every judge in America read your book and came away with the wisdom that book imparts. Where would we be then?
I think that we would realize that there are not the easy answers in the past that many judges seem to imply in their opinions, because the meaning of the First Amendment in the past was contested. And the place of religion in the United States has long been problematic. And it seems today that we're just in the latest chapter. And so it does seem like, at least in contemporary political debate, so often when people start talking about the past, what they're really doing is projecting their desired vision for the future somehow back on the past. And that's a complicated maneuver, because the past is often very different than we might imagine it.
David Sahat is a historian at Georgia State University and the author of The Myth of American Religious Freedom. I'm Peter Ronoff.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Bellow. Today on the show, we're looking at the ways past generations of Americans have argued over how to connect or disconnect church and state.
An early version of that argument played out in the summer of 1832. A cholera epidemic had just struck New York City, and it was hell. Victims suffered, losing fluid so quickly that their skin puckered and turned blue. The disease was responsible for more than 1,000 deaths in the first week alone. And then it began to spread, first to Philadelphia, and then as far as New Orleans.
Worst of all, no one knew what caused it. The most obvious answer was that cholera was a scourge sent by an angry god, which meant that a public health crisis was also a religious crisis.
So a church in New York wrote to President Andrew Jackson with a plea. He should declare a national day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer. National repentance, they thought, might ease the country's suffering.
But Jackson politely declined. He thought that religion ought to stay completely separate from matters of state, even in the midst of a crisis.
I sat down with historian Adam Jortner to discuss how that simple disagreement turned into a political firefight. Adam told me that the church's request didn't seem that controversial at the time. Other presidents, after all, had declared days of prayer in the past.
These fast days had been approved by George Washington approves one, James Madison approves one. So it's not that no one in the federal government had ever said, no, you can't have a fast day.
So what changed? I mean, you know, they sound like heavy hitters, Washington and Madison.
Well, Jackson's a pretty heavy hitter, too, and he is not in favor of organized religion. I'm going to come right out and say that. He's a religious guy, but Jackson is just a guy who doesn't like organized churches generally. When he's in the Tennessee legislature in 1796, he actually votes for a bill that says, if you're a minister, you can't hold political office. I think he really also did believe that there should be this total separation between church and state.
Now, I note that 1832 is a presidential election year.
Did presidential politics have anything to do with this decision and what followed?
Well, you know, no sooner has Jackson turned the Reformed Church down than Henry Clay, who's his arch rival and who everybody knows is going to run against him in 1832, Henry Clay comes up, stands up in the Senate, and he asks them to pass a bill asking for a day of fasting for God to avert the cholera.
And we need to point out this is before C-SPAN and Fox News.
That is correct, but it's not before newspapers. And I think that Clay is aware that Jackson has offended some people, particularly in the state of New York, and Clay knows he has got to win New York State. New York State has a third of the electoral votes he needs to win. And he probably picked this up because he knows that New York State is also where an enormous number of revivals have broken out in the 1820s and early 1830s. This is where Charles Finney, the great evangelist, has been holding his huge revivals, and he knows there are potential voters there. But he also knows that he, Henry Clay, is well known as a card-playing gambler. He's been involved in duels. He's a drinker. So he's not exactly the kind of person these sort of religious types are going to vote for. So he stands up and says, "I am a member of no religious sect. I regret that I am not. I wish that I was.
Wow.
And I might be a drinker and a gambler, but I think the state should recognize God and ask God for his protection."
So hold on. Time out here. We've got Jackson, the religious man who doesn't like organized religion. And we have Clay, who acknowledges that he's not a religious man, wishes that he were, but he introduces this legislation. Adam, is this a wedge issue?
I think it is. I think it is an attempt to sort of go to voters and say, if you are religious, you should vote for me and nothing else matters. Clay is trying to tap into a group of voters in New York State who haven't yet turned to politics. And it's a way of connecting the fear they're having over the cholera to the vote they're going to cast in November.
So tell me what each side goes on to argue here. I assume there's a big back and forth.
Once Clay's bill passes the Senate, and not too much opposition, but when it gets to the House, Jackson's allies are ready, and they accuse Clay of trying to subvert religion, of trying to become a tyrant. Actually, one of Jackson's supporters accuses Clay of prostituting our holy religion.
How did they explain the fact that previous presidents had done the very thing that they now thought was an abomination?
There's a guy named Julian Verplank, who's a congressman from the state of New York, and he actually points out that, you know, when Madison proposes a fast day in 1812, people got up and they started preaching about politics from the pulpit. And that what you get is people were if they didn't like Madison's administration, they railed against the government. If they did like Madison, they supported the government. And this was not the way churches should be operating. And I think that experience of a fast day, all those, you know, that would have been 20 years ago at that time, really affected the tenor of this debate, that they didn't want to have any more fast days.
Was this just a battle inside the Beltway? I know we didn't have a Beltway then. Or is this something that people on the ground were really passionate about?
I think that it's hard to tell from a distance of so many decades. But if you read what the newspapers are saying, you see this deep passion about preserving the separation of church and state. One of the newspapers actually says that Clay is a priest. It says, "Priest Clay, who is trying to amalgamate church and state." You know, people read those newspapers and they would gather together and then they would read it out loud to each other. So I think that there's a real feeling in Jacksonian America that separation of church and state is what makes democracy work.
So how does this work out?
Jackson wins. The House defeats Clay's resolution, and so it goes down. And then in November, Clay goes down. He gets crushed by Jackson. But there is sort of an afterthought to this, which is that a lot of state governors pass fast day resolutions in the wake of Clay's failure. And a lot of those pass. So I do think that the supporters of the fast day did end up getting some of what they wanted. They do get some governors to pass their resolution. And ultimately, you know, those Presbyterians and Baptists and Methodists in New York State do become part of Clay's future party, the Whig Party. They're strong supporters of the Whigs in later elections.
So what does this tell us about the use of religion for partisan purposes?
I think the lesson of this story is that, first of all, it's not that the arguments about church and state are religious people wanting more religion in politics and then irreligious people wanting less. I think there are religious people on both sides of the issue. It's possible to be religious and be afraid of church involvement in politics.
Right.
And I was shocked at the extent to which politicians were willing to go on record to defend the separation of church and state and didn't feel the need to apologize for it, that it was actually a positive good. But I also think this is a story where politicians go looking for religious voters. Sometimes church and state in the 21st century is conceived of as religious people want solutions to their problems. They go into politics. But it happens the other way around, too. Politicians can need supporters. They look around and they find religious voters and they say, ah, we will give you something that you want. We'll have more religion in politics and then you'll be part of our coalition and you'll support our other objectives.
So, Adam, tell me, how did the rates of cholera in states that passed resolutions compare to the rates of cholera in states that decided not to pray?
There is no difference that I know of.
Thank you for clearing up the record, and thanks for joining us on Backstory.
Thanks, Brian. It's my pleasure.
Adam Jortner is a historian at Auburn University.
In 1852, the Mormon Church publicly acknowledged that plural marriage, also known as polygamy, was part of their faith. And this did not go over well with many Americans outside of the Utah Territory. Many worried that Mormon elders were ensnaring young women into marriages with much older men.
So, in 1862, Congress passed the Moral Anti-Bigamy Act, which banned polygamy in the territories. By the 1870s, federal officials were arresting prominent Mormons for polygamy. This didn't sit well with church leaders, so they decided to challenge the constitutionality of the Morrill Act. To do that, they needed an appealing defendant.
The saints soon settled on a young man named George Reynolds. He was young, handsome, mild-mannered, and he only had two wives.
And I think they thought he belied the stereotype of the sort of fat old guy with a big beard who had, you know, six wives, each one younger than the last.
This is Sarah Baringer Gordon, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She says that by the time the trial began, the Mormon leaders had changed their strategy. The new plan was to try to get Reynolds acquitted.
When witnesses were called, they forgot that they knew George Reynolds. His neighbors had no idea whether he was known as a polygamist. No one could remember the wedding ceremony, and so on. And it looked, during the first day of the trial, as though Reynolds might get off because there simply was no evidence at the trial to prove that he was, in fact, a polygamist.
But I'm guessing that something happened. This is like a great courtroom drama. So then what happens?
Well, I'm afraid something did happen. There was a smart young lawyer who had showed up in the territory shortly after the Civil War. He was sitting in the courtroom and he saw this whole prosecution going south. And he suggested to the marshal that he go find the second Mrs. Reynolds and bring her to the court, which is what happened. She appeared in the courtroom. And as it also happens, she was visibly pregnant at that time. Her name had not been given as a witness, so she apparently was entirely unaware that everybody had forgotten they knew George Reynolds and that that was the program for the day. And she marched down, took the oath, sat in the witness box, and proudly identified herself as the second Mrs. Reynolds. And the guy who had forgotten whether he ever knew Reynolds or had performed a wedding ceremony, that he, in fact, had married them.
Oh, gosh.
And she provided the evidence that convicted her own husband.
The Mormons, I take it, after the appearance of the second Mrs. Reynolds, lose.
They called for an adjournment toward the end of the day, and the next morning they arrived in court with a new defense, saying that yes, they admitted that Reynolds was in fact married to more than one woman, but, and here's where the Constitution really comes in, but he was a member of the LDS Church, and as a loyal Latter-day Saint, if he was given the opportunity to practice polygamy, he must do so or be damned, so that this was a religious practice.
So my understanding is that this is makes it all the way to the Supreme Court?
Eventually it did. The case was argued in November 1878 and decided in early January 1879.
And so by this time, I assume the central question has been distilled in some way. And what does it boil down to? And what does Reynolds argue?
Well, there were several arguments made on his behalf. His lawyer was George Washington Biddle. He argued strenuously that the federal government had no jurisdiction over such domestic relationships in the territories. And at the very end, he tossed in the claim that, by the way, this was a religion and that was a separate defense. But most of the time he talked about technical legal claims of who had power where. And in the opinion of the Supreme Court, they virtually ignore all that jurisdictional stuff and say, well, really, the defense here is based on religion. And Reynolds claims that his religion commands him to behave this way, and so he has an excuse for not following the criminal law that the Congress has validly enacted. And then they say, if we let a guy like this redefine what counts as marriage and what counts as criminal behavior for himself just based on his religion, we're introducing anarchy. This is not what the Free Exercise Clause is about. We can't let this happen.
So, Sarah, how does this case fit into the evolving understanding of the separation of church and state in our country?
One crucial component of this separation is one we talked about a few moments ago, the fulcrum of marriage. Is marriage a civil institution? Is it a sacred institution? Who gets to decide? And what the Supreme Court said was, well, marriage has sacred elements, but it is a civil undertaking, and the secular government gets to decide its components and regulate marriage, so that state and federal legislatures have power to write statutes about adultery, to talk about inheritance, and so on. These are civil undertakings. So Reynolds is a landmark from the perspective of marriage as well as the perspective of religion.
So how did people around the country react to this decision then? They said, that's Utah, who cares? Or did they recognize that this has significance for all of us? And how did Mormons react to it?
Well, the New York Times ran a headline, Little Georgie Goes to Jail.
Wow.
The case was very, very popular around the country.
Right, right.
In other words, this seemed like a humanitarian result, the protection of women from the sexual depredation of men. The reaction within Utah was extremely outraged, a sense of betrayal of the religious liberty that Mormons argued was itself divinely inspired. You know, the Constitution as this spectacular document that had created space for a new revelation, the Book of Mormon, to enter. And one of the leaders of the church said that this is typical of a nation ripened for damnation, and they weren't going to give in. And only in 1890, 11 years after the Reynolds case was decided, and a huge swath of prosecutions later, thousands upon thousands of cases, did the leader of the Mormon Church, President Wilford Woodruff at that time, issue what was known as a manifesto, not quite a revelation, but a very important religious communique, saying that he would no longer counsel the saints to disobey the criminal laws of the land. And gradually, over years, the jangled nerves began to settle, and Utah was finally admitted as a state in 1896.
Sarah Berenger Gordon is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of the forthcoming book, The Place of Faith, about disestablishment in the 19th century.
It's time for a short break, but don't go away. When we get back, what do you get when a rabbi, a minister, and a priest get together? A legal revolution.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Backstory. I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Peter Onuf.
In the 1940s, researchers claim they had found an effective weapon against tooth decay, especially in children. Their solution was simple. We just needed to add a little bit of fluoride to everybody's drinking water. Public health officials eagerly embraced the strategy, so eagerly, in fact, that some people began to worry. Why were those public health officials rushing? What's the rush to put this stuff in the water? Was the stuff even healthy? After all, there were plenty of people who knew that fluoride could be toxic when it was taken in larger doses. So as the Cold War gathered steam, a few Americans started to ask some other very unsettling questions.
Mandrake.
Yes, Dad?
Have you ever seen a commie drink a glass of water?
Well, yeah, I can't say I have.
You may recognize this scene from Stanley Kubrick's 1964 Dr. Strangelove. In the film, General Jack Ripper is certain that the communists are behind a vast fluoride conspiracy.
It's incredibly obvious, isn't it? A foreign substance is introduced into our precious bodily fluids. Without the knowledge of the individual, certainly without any choice. That's the way your hardcore commie works.
It sounds ridiculous, but Kubrick was satirizing a very real fear. Andrew Case is a historian at Michigan State's Lyman Briggs College. He told me that by the 1950s, anxieties about a communist conspiracy were helping to fuel a backlash against fluoride.
So in 1954, there's a bill that's introduced into Congress. It never really gets out of committee. And the proposal would have banned federal, state, and municipal authorities from introducing fluoride compounds into water. One of the women that testifies in that hearing is a woman named Golda Franzen, who is a San Francisco housewife and also a leader of anti-fluoridation movements, not just in California, but in other places as well. And she really lays it out in this hearing when she says, quote, "I know that fluoridation is a communist scheme, frankly, the master plan, but I cannot prove it. For those who have informed me cannot testify, they would be liquidated if they did." And
another form of precious bodily fluid, liquidation.
Yes, liquidation, right. And but, you know, inside of that quote, I mean, it sort of captures lots of elements of conspiracy thinking. You know, there's a master plan, but we also can't reveal the master plan, right?
Right.
And there's lots of forces at work, some of which you can see and many which you cannot.
How did notions that communists were putting fluoride in the water fit with larger concerns about communism at the time?
I think it's really the notion of mass medication, right? So something applied regardless of individual choice. And a lot of times, fluoride compounds were added to public water supplies at the behest of a city council or local leadership without a popular referendum. And sort of experts from public health, from universities, scientists would say this is the way to go about it because they would lose oftentimes when it went to popular referendum. I mean, the fact that the public health service and local officials were proceeding with fluoride ahead of public acceptance of fluoride leads it into this kind of realm of the state moving against the will of its people. And I think it's a slippery slope type thing. If it starts with this, where does it end?
Yeah. So how do we get from referenda, where at least one argument is this is a communist plot, to Stanley Kubrick making fun of this in 1964 in Dr. Strangelove? What happens?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that happen. It becomes dangerous in some ways to have these sorts of ideas about fluoride or about communism. And it literally becomes absurd, right? And that's what Kubrick is calling out, is the absurdity of fluoride. And look what it could lead to, right? I mean, Ripper is driven mad by his obsession with fluoride enough to launch the Doomsday Plan, right?
Right.
And what could be more absurd than that, than a man, you know, consumed by his own bodily fears and putting the world at risk as a result?
Or if I could just add, Joe McCarthy, the famous anti-communist crusader, turning on the U.S. Army kind of undermines whatever legitimacy he has. And many argued at the time in the 1950s actually undermined America's ability to stand up to communism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So if I understand correctly, you're saying that conspiracy theory kind of put fluoride on the map or certainly got a lot of attention in the 1950s. And then associating fluoride with right-wing kooks took it off the map.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say that by painting it in a corner, red painting it in the corner perhaps, it becomes the most absurd thing. And you see a huge increase in the number of fluoride referenda and states pass mandatory fluoridation laws. I think Connecticut is the first one in the early 1960s. And over the course of the 1960s and 1970s, the percentage of American water supplies that are fluoridated gradually increases over time.
And yet, I gather there were some concerns totally unrelated to communist conspiracy emerging in the mid to late 1960s about fluoride. Could you tell me about those?
Yeah, so one of the things that I've tracked is what I call them naturalist anti-fluoridationists, natural antis, and these are folks that did not deny that fluoride was an important part of the body's health. They reject fluoride when it's artificially produced and artificially entered into our water supplies. And one of the things that we see is, you know, people with more education and who are less sort of isolated from American political life begin to take on the anti-fluoridation stance in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and they're responsive to this notion of choice, that if I want fluoride in my body, I can have it. It shouldn't be applied, broadly speaking, to the entire population.
Now, Andrew, you're talking about educated people now who are questioning fluoride. They couldn't possibly be susceptible to conspiracy thinking, could they?
No, this is the thing, is that there's a, you know, conspiracies have a way of running across the political spectrum. In a lot of ways, if you swap out the communist lingo that's very 1954 and look at the way it's, you know, described as a collusion of Alcoa and the U.S. Public Health Service.
Now, Alcoa, I didn't see that coming. How does Alcoa enter the picture?
Yeah, so sodium fluoride is a byproduct of aluminum production. So Alcoa is also the one that is selling the fluoride compounds to municipal water supplies. It's really about them finding a profitable use for what would otherwise be a waste product.
And it's worth mentioning that aluminum manufacture almost by definition is a monopoly or oligopoly, right? There aren't many Alcoas out there competing with each other.
Right, right. And there's, I don't remember all of the details, but, you know, there's like a former Alcoa executive who, you know, is on so-and-so committee. And, you know, the pieces all kind of fit together, as always, as you would suspect. So the naturalist anti-fluoridationists see fluoride as part of a bigger organization of big businesses and big science that are trying to put this material in our water and also continue to feed us certain types of food that, if our teeth weren't fortified, would be really bad. So refined grains, sugars.
I see. All so of it's that. So it can keep eating all the junk.
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the riddles, of course, is, you know, why would the American Dental Association want to put something in your water that, in theory, means that we would go to the dentist less, right? Is one of the riddles that is never really well answered. And the bigger story is that, you know, fluoride really was a progressive public health idea in the 40s and the 50s about giving children, regardless of their socioeconomic background, the access to good dental health. And that's what the progressive dentists of these states were really interested in the 1950s. And I take those folks at their word and that they weren't part. Of course, that's part of me being a part of a conspiracy and all of that sort of stuff, of me defending, you know, I'm at a state university, part of a big land grant system. So that's, of course, what you'd expect somebody like me to say.
Yes, it's exactly what I would expect. Andrew, thank you for joining us on Backstory. And I want to remind all our listeners that under the Affordable Health Care Act, they will be able to keep their own fluoride.
Absolutely, absolutely. And their tinfoil hats.
Andrew Case is an instructor in history at the Lyman Briggs College at Michigan State University.
As of this year, an estimated 40,000 books have been written about the presidency of John F. Kennedy. We can be sure that a good percentage of them have at least addressed the question of Kennedy's assassination. But it was one film that has had arguably the largest impact on Americans' understanding of that day in Dallas, and that's the 1991 blockbuster JFK. It portrayed a vast conspiracy to kill the president that involved the CIA, FBI, mafia, and even White House players.
In an attempt to address the public commotion that followed the film's release, Congress passed what's known as the JFK Records Act. It mandated the declassification of all government records relating to the assassination.
That really became the point at which I began to go to the National Archives and read systematically through the new material and try to understand what was the story that had not come out before.
This is Jefferson Morley. At the time, he was working as a reporter for the Washington Post. Since then, he's become an assassination maven of sorts. I sat down with him to talk about what drew him to the story in the first place.
By that time, I really sort of had a fear and loathing of theories, and I decided I would never write about JFK assassination theories, and I never have, but rather that I would always try and just report new facts. And so I decided to focus very narrowly on the CIA and a classic kind of investigative reporter's question. What did the CIA know about Lee Harvey Oswald, and when did they know it? And in fact, what the records that I found showed is that the CIA had been watching Lee Harvey Oswald very closely for 4 years before President Kennedy was killed, from when he defected to the Soviet Union in October 1959 until he returned from Mexico City in October 1963. And if it had been known in November 1963 just how closely senior CIA officers had been watching Oswald, a lot of people would have lost their jobs at the CIA. It was a remarkable intelligence failure by very high-ranking CIA officials.
And is that the big takeaway from your research, from your perspective, a massive intelligence failure, or is there more?
It's very hard to tell. Was their intelligence failure a matter of negligence, or was it a matter of reckless disregard? And I think we don't have enough information to answer that question. A lot of CIA files have been destroyed, but there still are 1,100 CIA documents related to the assassination that have never been made public. And so it's possible that in that material we will get some decisive new insights into the causes of the assassination.
So let me ask you, who killed Kennedy?
You know, I don't know. And I get in trouble with my conspiracy-minded friends for saying that. You know what I say? There's a lot of implausible theories about who killed Kennedy, and the notion that one man killed Kennedy for no reason is one of them. I think it's more likely that Kennedy was killed by his enemies within his own government, which is something that Bobby and Jackie Kennedy thought. That's something that Fidel Castro thought. It's not an irrational or crazy way to look at it.
And, you know, if you had to put money on it, it's your bet that that is the case, that there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy that came from within the government?
I'm genuinely not sure, but, you know, I lean that
way. I understand.
I think that's more than 50% likely. How much more over 50% varies from day to day. Sometimes I go up to 80 and sometimes I go down to 50.5%.
What makes you go up to 80?
I mean, when you see the official malfeasance that followed the assassination, when you see how often people in the CIA hid things from the Warren Commission, people in the FBI destroyed evidence. To me, it's very hard to believe that they did all of that to hide nothing.
Yes.
The counterargument, people say, oh, Jeff, you know, they're secretive agencies. They were hiding the fact that they were embarrassed, you know. Really? I think, you know, when people go to that length, when they risk, you know, destroying evidence, that's obstruction of justice. When people risk a felony, they're doing that to hide nothing important. As a reporter, I'm skeptical.
Jeff, we are in the midst of a disastrous rollout of the Affordable Health Care Act. The government, it would appear, can't even build a website that works. My question about this has always been, how could a conspiracy from within the government be carried out so efficiently and then covered up so effectively, perfectly, you might say, for 50 years now?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's been covered up perfectly, because after all, most people think that there was a conspiracy, and they think that because of the evidence that they've seen about, the government's handling of the investigation.
But Jeff, you yourself really don't know what happened. When I say perfectly, I mean, if somebody like you can't tell me who killed Kennedy, then, well, nothing's perfect, but it seems pretty near perfect.
Well, what we have is a lot of evidence in front of us. And if you think of evidence as bricks in a wall, and proof is the wall.
Uh-huh.
You know, we don't have a wall of proof in the Kennedy assassination, but we do have these stacks of bricks which tell us, one, Oswald was the object of close and constant attention.
Yes.
Two, the people who were paying attention to him were not surveillance personnel. They were operations officers. And so their job was to mount covert operations, and covert operations, as one CIA man famously said, our secret from inception to eternity.
And along with that, it sounds like you are almost more concerned with the cover-up that followed, whatever reasons Kennedy was assassinated for, than the assassination itself.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the cover-up is what matters to us today. The intellectual authors of Kennedy's death, if there were any besides Oswald, are all dead. So there's not going to be a criminal trial. One thing that's very striking about the Kennedy assassination is if you look at Americans' confidence in government over time, it's very high from the end of World War II.
Yep.
And it begins to decline in about October 1964 when the Warren Report is issued.
This is when it declines.
That's exactly when
it
declines.
You're absolutely right.
And it goes down. And it hasn't really recovered. And I think clearing the air, I think historical reconciliation around this would be a way of regaining confidence in our collective purpose.
Jeff, thanks so much for joining us on Backstory today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Jefferson Morley moderates the website jfkfacts.org. He's the author of Our Man in Mexico, Winston Scott and the Hidden History of the CIA.
That's going to do it for us today, but we'll be waiting for you online. Pay us a visit at backstoryradio.org and let us know what conspiracy theory best represents our current moment. As always, you can find a lot of other Backstory extras on our Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr pages. Our handle is Backstory Radio. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Jess Ingebretson, Nina Ernest, and Andrew Parsons. Emily Charnock is our research and web coordinator, and Jamal Milner is our engineer. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the University of Virginia, Weinstein Properties, an anonymous donor, and the History Channel. History made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.